Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers between Silicon Valley, Hollywood, and Madison Avenue. And as a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Tommy Silverman. Tommy's a founder and partner in the legendary New Music Seminar, one of our industry's most influential music business conventions, led by the voices that disrupt the conventional, tackle key issues, and provide a stage for trailblazing artists to shine. From breakout indie artists to visionary CEOs and execs, New Music Seminar is where high-level discussions and interactions help craft solutions for this era of the music business. Tommy's also the founder and CEO of Tommy Boy, the legendary hip-hop and electronic label that started in New York City in the early 90s and is credited with launching the careers of such notable hip-hop legends as Queen Latifah, House of Pain, De La Soul, and Naughty by Nature, among others. In 2015, the New Music Seminar will take place at the Wyndham New Yorker Hotel and throughout various Manhattan music venues from June 21st to 23rd. So I hope many of our listeners that are in New York will attend, and those interested in being at the forefront will fly out and join Tommy and his bunch there. Tommy's a returning guest to the show, and he always has provocative insights to share. So welcome back, Tommy.
Thank you, Kelly.
It's always great to have you. I welcome your voice and your insights. You're such a trendsetter.
It's great to be here, and it's just, you know, so many balls. You just got to keep swinging at them because change never stops. It seems like it's accelerating, doesn't it?
That is so true. And we're gonna move around a little bit. I want to dive in first about the New Music Seminar because it's upon us, but I've got some other key things I'd love for us to talk through as well. So let's start with the New Music Seminar. Obviously, it's just coming up in a couple of weeks. And you say that new questions are asked every year, as they should be, in pursuit of relevant contemporary solutions that will help to restore the record business back to its former glory. And this year's theme is transforming the music industry. So what are a few of the most pressing issues that you're planning to discuss and explore at this year's show?
For the last year, we've been championing this kind of idea of switching our mentality as a music business from a sales-oriented unit mentality to an access-oriented attention mentality. How do we monetize attention? Because that's the world we're moving toward. In fact, it's the world we've always been in, but we've always monetized music by selling records.
Right.
And in the new world, I believe there'll still be music that will be sold, and a lot more than most people believe. But I think that the highest ARPU, average revenue per user, will come from subscription streaming. So our focus over the last few years is how do we build a $100 billion music business when we're stuck at a $15 billion business at wholesale, something like $26 or $7 billion at retail. What can we do to get to 100? Is it possible? And what's the path? To me, these are the only questions worth asking in the music business today, and nobody's asking these questions. So we really started the New Music Seminar to ask these questions and other questions about how artists can break through in a world where the internet was supposed to make it easier, but it turned out to make it harder for everybody. And we're trying to sort of blaze a path for discovery and a new way of looking at things.
It has become a bit fragmented, but from my perspective, it's good and bad, because more innovation has come on the scene. The playing field's been leveled where artists have more control than ever. And, you know, we've got whole new business models that didn't exist before. So let me ask you, why 2015 feels like such a critical year for the music subscription and streaming sectors?
So because since we've been pushing this concept of thinking about average revenue per user, the labels fought it for the first few years, and now they are accepting it. And Lucian Grange and Doug Morris have come out against ad-supported streaming, for example, the YouTube model or the Spotify free model, in some way. And we think it's valiant that they're understanding that we need to move the business to the highest potential per user value, but at the same time we have to monetize as many of people as possible, and there are two different strategies. And we also have to understand that on the other side of monetizing ad-supported models, we have illegal pirate models that are sitting there waiting to step in. So we're dealing with building a very complex ecosystem. We're not just selling, you know, albums and cassettes. You know, now we're selling everything, and we're renting it, and we're doing, you know, it's, there's six different revenue centers we have to think about now and look at it as a sensitive ecosystem, and there are overlaps between all of them, and they affect each other. And, you know, we're building, you know, we're building this carefully, and I think the industry has to have a long-term 10-year look at where we're going and what we're building. And at the seminar, we're helping to cultivate that mentality.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know whether you have a colleague I think we share in common, Jeff Price, formerly of TuneCore, now Audiam, as a part of the music seminar. But he's one of he's been one of my favorite voices and pundits for years. I find myself nodding vigorously with most of what he comes up with. And I don't know if you saw it, Tommy, but just today as we're doing this interview, he published a set of pretty incredible statistics on music streaming, interactive streaming, for 2014. And the details that he's got in this report that he's put out on Audiam.com today on his blog are really quite insightful. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's worth taking a look at for you and for our listeners. Based on some of the numbers he came up with, for example, in December of 2014, an artist who controlled the rights to their recording and compositions needed 17% more streams to make the same amount in royalties in December as they'd made in the 11 months earlier from January.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to look at the music business on a unit basis, and part of the unit basis is what are the stream equivalent albums, you know, trying to make apples fit into oranges. The new business, again, which is based on attention, worldwide there are only 41 million as of the end of February, the end of 2014, the dates he's talking about. There are only 41 million music subscribers in the world. That's not very many. In America, there are only 7.6 million music subscribers. That's practically nothing. So, you know, you can't really compare revenue on a per unit basis. You may be earning double or triple. I've done analyses of my own that identify the net value to the industry and to the artists and to the labels, each being different numbers, average revenue per user from subscription streaming, from ad-supported streaming, from physical sales, and from digital downloads. And the numbers are significantly higher. They're about 40% higher than digital downloads, and they're about three times higher than physical record sales at net, because you have to back out manufacturing costs and mechanical costs to make it apples to apples. And they're more than 10 to 12 times higher than advertising supported streaming. So when you look at it that way, you can't look at it and how much money you're making, because there's so few people subscribing.
Right.
You know, and there's so they haven't been able to monetize the ad supported streaming well enough yet. So I believe the ad supported streaming can generate a much higher ARPU than it currently generates. But you also have to look at the kind of consumer that uses that. Is it a lean back consumer or a lean forward consumer? Just a chilled out consumer that doesn't really buy music or never bought music, but at least they're contributing something now. You know, for example, all the people that listen to terrestrial radio don't pay anything to the record companies.
Correct.
And the artists. So, and that's 54% of all of the music listens in any given year, at least at this point. So, you know, half of all the music listening goes unmonetized in America. So the shift to ad-supported, although it may not be as big or may not even be one-tenth as big, it's still a hell of a lot bigger than zero. So we have to look at, you know, building this ecosystem where everything generates revenues of some sort for artists at some point and their investors. So, you know, I look at it a different way. When people say, oh, they had 8 million streams and they only made, you know, $70, I don't even think about it that way. I'm talking to labels now, and the labels are Warner announced in the last month that in the first quarter they generated more money from subscription than they did from downloads. And so that's a pretty big thing. And I've talked to a lot of labels, independent labels, that are generating more revenue from Spotify alone than they're generating from iTunes. So Spotify has moved to that. Means they're for these labels, they're already the number one revenue supplier with their small, only 15 million paid subscribers so far. What happens when they get to 50 million? I mean, the number will be quadruple. So really, I'm very excited about where it's going. I think it's a mistake to look at the business that way, because you're not there's two active ingredients: monthly average users and the amount of revenue per user.
Indeed,
and they both are important. So if the MAU is very small, like it is now, it doesn't really generate the revenue yet, but it will.
And I agree with that logic, Tommy. And I've got to say, it's a little unfair, even to Jeff, for me to have just pulled one little sentence out of his findings, because, you know, you don't have the context of what he was trying to convey. But I think that it's worth taking a look. When somebody does that kind of diligence and rigor, it's welcome, because so much of what we talk about is anecdotal, and here's somebody who's put some pencil to paper about it. So, you know, any kind of good data is always helpful as far as I'm concerned.
Right. We launched, I believe in that, we launched our own study at the seminar earlier in the year of a five-year projection of the six revenue centers that we believe will be the most significant revenue streams for the music industry for the next 5 years, and we're identifying what percentage of total revenue that would be. And we did it for labels, artists, and the industry as a whole, and it's very interesting to see, for example, what a big role SoundExchange will play in revenues moving forward.
Yeah, and actually that's a good point I was going to bring up, but before I segue there, how can listeners get access to the report that you guys did?
A lot of it was written up in Billboard. Glenn Peoples did a thing on it. I guess if you Google Tom Silverman revenue projections, you'll find it there. Billboard published it online in, I think, April.
Understood. Very good. April 2015. Yeah. So anybody who's interested, go check that out. Now, I want to segue into SoundExchange for in just a moment, Tommy, but could you explain to listeners who may not be as familiar with NMS or not be repeat attendees, who should attend and why?
Of course. The New Music Seminar is designed for the entire industry. It's super important for artists and songwriters and producers, and also for people who are studying music or in the music business who want to get into the music business, because most of the people that are running the labels today came up through the New Music Seminar in the 80s. And when they see that you're a New Music Seminar attendee on your resume, it puts you ahead of everybody else, because they know what that is. They know what it means. And it means that you care enough about the future of the music business to invest in yourself that way. And, you know, we find it really separates the wheat from the chaff. So a lot of people have gotten jobs at the seminar or started new businesses at the seminar. Many people have actually also met their husbands or wives to be at the music seminar. It's a fun place to go. I mean, it's fun, but it's exciting because you can see the new music business being evolving right before your eyes. And in those 2 days, you get a snapshot of everything that's happening and where change, you know, it's the crux of change, and you're right in the crucible. So there's really not another conference like that. Plus, we are the only conference that's driven by mission. You know, I'm in the music business. I've been in the music business for over 35 years, and I've seen it go from the height in 1999 to the depths that it's in now. And, you know, the after inflation revenue value of the music industry today is the same as it was in 1966. If you look at the RIAA revenue numbers that are reported, and that's, it's really unfair. I mean, music is the most important thing in the world. It's the biggest driver of happiness in the world, and yet it's undervalued so substantially. I don't think music is, you know, generates one tenth of what it should be generating. So, you know, I'm just committing all of my efforts to try to make music generate more revenue, and so that artists, more artists can be signed, and more artists can have people invest in their career, and more artists will get an opportunity to break, which they all deserve.
I couldn't agree more about that. I've been a proponent of artists and monetizing their craft and being rewarded for their hard work and their efforts and bringing so much enjoyment for my whole career as well. So I share that with you. Now, Tommy, as you say, you do describe New Music Seminar as a catalyst for change. And when it was launched initially, it was the first to pioneer the kinds of combination of panels and workshops and live showcases that would become the industry standard for such get-togethers. Could you share with some of our listeners who may not be as familiar, what gave you the inspiration to launch it and do something a little different? And how was it different at the time?
Well, at the time I was running a newsletter for DJs. I hadn't even started Tommy Boy yet. It was the sort of the vehicle, the newsletter that DJs all read to find out about what was happening back in the late 70s and the early 80s. And I had a partner, Mark Josephson, who ran a newsletter for rock DJs and had a record pool called Rock Pool that serviced records to rock DJs. And together we put our lists together and we reached out and we gave a voice to the DJ community and created a conference around all of the issues that we thought weren't being addressed. And we gave a voice to people who weren't being heard, and we were all upstarts. So we all thought there was a better way that the business could be run. And also there was amazing new music that was just starting. It was the birth of hip hop. It was the birth of house music. It was the birth of all new kinds of rock, you know, that we call alternative now, and other types of rock that were all, the 80s were an amazing period where music forms were gestating.
Right.
We're in a similar situation today. That's why I came back to start the seminar in 2009 again after a 15-year hiatus, because now the issue is how people consume music more than the music itself. It's because, you know, we're going through an entire paradigm shift in, as to how we even see the business, and our industry was fighting that shift instead of embracing it. So we needed to have a conference that brought people together who were the visionaries and who the futurists who could see another way.
Absolutely.
Because I'm on the board of RAAA, on A2IM, Merlin, at the time Sound Exchange, and you know, nobody was really thinking more than 2 or 3 years in the future, and things were dropping 10-20% a year, and there was no end in sight, and nobody was saying, well, what's going to replace the record business that's going away? And no
right.
one was even having that discussion. It blew my mind. How come at RAAA this is not a priority to discuss what's going to replace this?
Actually, to be fair, I recall attending a number of different conferences. I even produced my own in the late 90s on what was to become of the industry over the next 5 to 10 years. There was web noise and plug-in and all those kind of – so we were all trying to figure it out and corral the powers that be. It's just that at the time, the major labels didn't really want to change the models.
Even as late as 2008, they weren't willing to change the models. And, you know, even now when they're – you know, whenever they have the – you hear the word cannibalization mentioned, you know there's some small thinking going on,
mm-hmm,
right? Because
mm-hmm.
the assumption that the music business is a zero-sum game is so outdated, it's beyond belief, right?
I couldn't agree
you know,
more.
How many people don't listen to Pandora, buy vinyl or CDs or download some kind of buying of music, and also either subscribe to a streaming service or use YouTube? You know, you're using 3 or 4 different things. They're all generating revenue at some level, not one. So, you know, you are the culminating value of not just one revenue center, but many. You know, some people may only listen to FM radio, but maybe they listen to Sirius, and Sirius may generate $300 million for Sound Exchange to distribute.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So that's great. You know, that's new revenue that we didn't have before, $773 million last year, and on the way to $1 billion next year. And that's new revenue for the music industry. So, you know, we have to be open to it. And you'd be surprised that some of the labels are upset about Sound Exchange because they don't get to collect the money and recoup it against unrecouped balances, and 50% is paid to artists, and they can't use it as regular revenue. And what if Pandora was, why shouldn't they be paying the same thing that Spotify is paying, you know? And it's obviously, it's not the same thing.
They're
different levels of service.
This is going to be a hot topic at this year's conference, I can tell. I know you're featuring the Sound Exchange Summit, which is an entire day focused on rights owners and royalty collection and entertainment law and advocacy, from the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act to the Protecting the Rights of Musicians Act. So clearly you're trying to put a stake in the ground to drive this conversation.
Well, yes, and for artists to understand what it is. But you know, it's even more than that. So this year, for the first time, and I don't think anybody's ever done it before at a conference, we're having a separate conversation about ad-supported streaming. And on a different day, we're doing one on subscription streaming, because subscription music has to be looked at very differently. And so we're going to dissect both of them and identify their place in the ecosystem. I listened to the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference today, and
yeah,
Jimmy Iovine spoke.
The launch of Apple Music.
When they launched the Apple Music thing. And what I loved was I heard the word ecosystem mentioned over and over again, and that's the right way to look at it, because we're entering an ecosystem. It's not all or nothing anymore. It's everything, and we have to, you know, embrace it all and see how we can plug it all in and how we can weave it together so we can get the maximum. Think about the movie business and their windowing model. You know, look at all the different ways they generate revenue. The highest generation may be box office. The next highest at one point was DVD sales. You know, international, you know, airline, whatever, hotel rooms, you know, VOD. They're thinking about all the different ways.
I agree more. Those are, in my way of thinking and what I've been pontificating all these years, is spokes on a wheel of incremental revenue, found money. Although I would argue that I think that on the film side, some of those windows are obviously collapsing. They've still done a better job than the music industry in embracing all of those different, to your point, all of those different opportunities.
Yeah, some are collapsing and new ones are opening. You know, I buy movies on, you know, my Apple TV, and other people do, and or they use Netflix, and
exactly,
those are revenue streams that didn't exist before. So, you know, you have to really look at it as a whole. The other thing that's, we're doing a movement this year on the developing world, music in the developing world. In the next 5 years, as subscription streaming starts to peak out, that most of the growth in the music business will come beyond the 26 countries that represent 97% or 93% of all of the revenue in the music business. 26 countries that all have a per capita music generation, revenue generation of 2%, $2 per capita or more, are the top 26 countries. All of the other countries together only generate 7% of all the music industry revenue. But those countries, all of the other countries, already have something like 68% of the smartphones in the world. And in 10 years, they're going to have 80% or 90% of the smartphones in the world. And putting music in smartphones and monetizing it there, it's the best way to monetize music. And don't you think that it's possible that in 10 or 15 years, the developing world will be nearly equal to the revenues of the rest of it, because it's so
I'd
much
like
bigger
to believe
in terms
that.
Of population?
And I'd like to believe that based on the stats you quoted, and also because they don't carry the burden of legacy models.
That's true. They're going directly to that. They never really bought records, but they all love music and they need more music, and everybody's phone could theoretically hold all the music in the world. There's 1.6 million smartphones in the world last year, and you know, there's probably 400,000 or 500,000 new ones added last year, and that's unique users. That's not numbers of devices.
That's right.
It's a pretty big number, and
yeah,
we believe it's going to get to 3 million by 2020.
I share your optimism about what's possible if people will just open their minds and look at a broader suite of opportunities. To that end, Tommy, I'm wondering why you believe that we should embrace derivative works as an opportunity rather than something to be ignored or rejected.
Well, derivative works has been something that's been rejected from the record side, but from the publishing side, it's been accepted. Think about things like cover records and cover songs. You know,
yeah,
it's a huge part. And also sync, usage of music in film, TV, and advertising is a huge percentage of the publisher and songwriter's revenue. We don't do as much, with the exception of sampling, which is largely focused on hip-hop and, you know, the urban pop sort of kinds of genres, the music industry has shut the door to that because there is no statutory right to cover song on the master side or to use it for sampling. But all of the technology exists to do that. And the real thing that blew my mind was looking at YouTube. More than half of all the music industry revenue from YouTube comes from user-generated content, despite the fact that user-generated content are those are the videos that people make using somebody's song, a Beyonce
Correct.
Song or any song. And there are thousands of those that happen, and they generate so much attention that they can monetize actually higher than the premium content, the original, even though the CPM, the amount of money that, the advertising can generate on a per minute basis, is one quarter the amount of premium content, and that many publishers and labels don't agree to turn on the monetization switch because you have to have both the master side and the publishing side authorized in order to even monetize. So much of the stuff goes unmonetized. But despite all of that, probably 60% or more of all of the YouTube music revenue is generated from user-generated content. And it made me think, if we had Music ID like they have in YouTube and some other technologies, we could probably create a platform that would allow people to use stem mixes from original works easily and inexpensively and generate a new work that would be co-owned by the new creator and the original creator and generate all kinds of additional revenues in
well,
a multi-level
fact,
marketing approach.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Tommy. In fact, you've touched on not one, but two startups that address those issues you touched on. The first being our friend Jeff Price again with Audiam, with a goal of monetizing YouTube streams and ensuring that the right songwriters and artists make sure they get properly paid as a result. And the other being the stem remixes comes to a venture called Jamit, which is an application on iOS and Android that separates mastered tracks, including vocals, and allows the user to put their own guitar solos in or their own vocals while the rest of the instruments remain original and repopulate.
Wait a second. That called Jamit?
Jamit, yes. Yeah.
There's also one called Jam Bandit. Have you seen that one?
Yes, that's another one with a different orientation. But the point is, now with music and tech, we've got all kinds of opportunities to close those gaps that you're bringing up. And I'm curious which music tech opportunities you may be most excited about, some of which I'm sure you're going to be showcasing at the seminar.
I think that there's tons of them. I think it's still early days for derivative works, but you'll say we heard it first at the New Music Seminar. It could be a $3 or $4 billion business for the music business eventually.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All of these records that could be re-released in these different forms. In fact, this month, Native Instruments is launching a stem format. Native Instruments creates Tractor and a bunch of DJ tools and other things, and
right.
They're creating a thing called Stems with a capital S that they want to make available as sort of a technological package in which to offer these and sell them on Beatport and other places like that. But I think that the real big upside is going to be when those stems get used to create new product. And there's another company that I'm talking with out of Nashville that's got this technology that they'll be able to both watermark the stems and also micro scan the stems so they can be identified in two different ways as they get used throughout the internet and generate revenues. I mean, there could be a number one record that, you know, that has a stem in it, and 50% of the revenue of that might go to the stem owner, creating massive new revenue for a song that was out 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago. We don't know.
Yeah. And by the way, we're talking about the music side. Don't forget the potential with the video side, video collaboration among artists across the world. This is the province of our friend Kevin Godley with his startup out of Dublin, Ireland, called Whole World Band. And he's enabling collaboration, global collaboration, where, you know, a known artist can come in and literally co-create a brand new song with people he's never met from around the world, choose the best contributors, and then that becomes the song, and all of those individual unknown artists get paid. They become songwriting, they share a title on the songwriting, and they get publishing from that, and they get visibility and exposure.
Yeah, she's been at the seminar a couple of times, and I think what he's doing is really great. I think, you know, being able to jam with your favorite stars is a great one.
Yeah.
I just got a copy of this Jam Bandit app, which is a lot of fun because you don't have to be a musician to be able to do it. It turns your iPhone or iPad into a million different instruments, and you can play a song like Statesboro Blues by the Allman Brothers, and then you can't play a wrong note. You can play the Fender Rhodes, you can play the organ, you can play the guitar, any of these instruments, and you know it plays progressions that are in time and in key with so that you only can sound great. And it's unbelievable. Once you get into this, it's like it just makes you so happy.
People discouraged, and they can actually feel like they're contributing to making music. It sparks all kinds of creativity.
They're geniuses who created this thing. It's unbelievable.
And there's so much more like that. That's why it's so exciting to be in the middle of the music tech space from my perspective. But one last question I have about the seminar, Tommy, and that's obviously it's also a festival, which includes three nights of live music featuring more than 50 of the best emerging artists that are going to take over venues in the East Village and Lower East Side of New York City. What are some of the names we can expect to see on stage this year?
So we're fully committed to this program we have called Artists on the Verge. Every year we have a new class of 100 artists that we feel are most ready to break. We do a lot of investigations. We look at their social profile. We look at their rate of growth. We look at what they're doing live, and we listen to their music, and we have a large group of music listeners. And this isn't something you can submit to. This is a research project that we do each year. And from these 100, we invite 30 or 40 of them to come to New York and play over the two or three days, and we actually pick three that we consider the best, and they vie for this prize that we give out each year that's $50,000 to $100,000 of goods and services that benefit these artists. And
yeah.
Really, because we think every artist, it's just so hard to break now. Every artist needs all the help they can get, and, you know, we get iHeartRadio has a station that's, that just plays that music, so you can go on iHeartRadio and listen to it. You know, we do a lot of things to try to increase the visibility for these 100 artists, do a big press campaign to promote them. And every year we get better and better, and more of them get signed and go on to become successful. The best thing to do is to go to just do Google New Music Seminar AOV, and it'll take you right there, and you'll see the full list of 100, and you can click on any of them and listen and watch their videos. They're linked, so it makes it super easy for somebody to check it out. And I'd rather not mention one or two, because the ones that I didn't mention will get mad.
Oh, no,
they're all great.
Obviously. I respect that, and I think it's fantastic. Speaking as a former A&R person, you got to find a way to get these artists some focus in the 21st century, because it's a very different world than the one we came up in.
Yep.
So, again, newmusicseminar.com is the website. If you want to check out Artists on the Verge, that's /AOV after newmusicseminar.com. And I have one last question about the seminar, and that is, Tommy, I recall you and Dave Laurie used to do some on the West Coast. Am I going to sound ignorant if I ask what's happened with the West Coast version of NMS?
We did one. Our original idea was to do five around the country, four or five, and we did New York, Chicago, LA, and that was, we were going to cycle that around, and then we were going to do Texas and Atlanta, because we thought that we wanted to be within driving distance of most of the artists in the country. The focus initially was 1,000 true fans, breaking through the obscurity zone, helping artists break through. We believed that the DIY business was going to explode and more artists were going to break through. But it actually didn't happen that way. And it turned out that the reason why artists weren't breaking through was because the people who invest in artists, usually labels, but also others, had stopped investing because the win is so small for when you're successful, it didn't justify the risk. You know, the music business is a venture capital business. It's
a
high-risk business. So
yeah.
It requires a big return. And if the big return's not there, the investors go away. And when the investors go away, horrible things happen. You know, bands don't get signed. The bands that do get signed get one single and then they're dropped. You know, nobody goes two albums anymore. You know,
exactly.
Nobody
gets
there's
no
one
artist,
album. If
no artist,
no artist development. No.
Yeah.
And I can understand why, you know.
I can too.
70% less people working in the music business. You know, everyone's had pay cuts and, you know, there are no more assistants, you know, so there's less jobs in the music business for everybody and the next generation has a harder time breaking through. We have to, this is the reason for the seminar. So we shifted our focus a little bit from the DIY focus that we were working with to, and the other thing that was discouraging to me was we would preach DIY. Here's Reverb Nation, here's this one, here's that one. You can put all these tools together and you can do it yourself. You can go from zero to 50 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour at least on your own. And
right.
I'd make this speech and then 10 people would come up and hand me a CD to try to get signed. And I'd go, you know, dude, you're not hearing what I'm saying. But the reality is they don't want to do all that work. They don't want to focus on the social graph. They want to focus on making music, writing music, producing music, performing music, getting their live show great. You know what? That's a full-time job that most people fail in anyway. Asking artists to do that plus run their own label and their own business, I think is probably a big mistake. And I think artists thought it was a mistake. That's not what they want to do. So eventually everyone who was saying maybe you don't need a label anymore, maybe, you know, there's three or four artists, maybe Zoe Keating doesn't need a label, and maybe, like, you know, Amanda Palmer doesn't need a label, and maybe there's 30 or 40 other people that don't need a label, but, you know, there's a million people that would love to have a label, and if the economics were corrected, which is what we're focusing on now, you know, those million artists would have a label, and they'd have a team behind them, and, you know, they'd have investors that would care about their future, and they'd get more shots, and I think they need more shots. They deserve it. There's great music out there.
I agree. Now, I have just a couple more questions, Tommy, mindful of your generosity with your time, but I'm respectful of that. Having a trusted advisor is so important, and I'm curious who have been some of your mentors along the way, and obviously some of, you know, have you mentored others? I know the answer to that question.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I feel blessed to have such amazing mentors, but my definition of mentor is not trusted advisor. Some of my best mentors were not necessarily trusted, you know, or advisors, but they were people that I was able to be around and studied and learn from them and feel their energy and what made them special. So I've had, you know, a motley crew of advisors mentors. One of them was Morris Levy, who was kind of famous for Roulette Records and the Strawberries record chain in Boston, and he's also known to be connected to the Gambino crime syndicate in some ways. And, you know, I don't know whether that's true or that wasn't true, but he was a person that was more feared than loved, probably. But I got many audiences with him, and I got a chance to observe him in action over a few years while he was still active, and I ended up becoming friends with his son when he was just getting into the music business, Adam. So he was a person who I consider a mentor, although he never advised me, and I would never call him trusted.
You know, quite frankly, you're right about that correction. They're not the same. Trusted advisor and mentor, not the same.
Yeah.
Two different people
Yeah. I'm very blessed to have Chris Blackwell as a mentor. Ahmet Erdogan was a big mentor to me. Also, Mo Austin, who I did a deal with with Warner Brothers and Tommy Boy, and spent a lot of my career over there with him and learned so much from there. You know, there were others as well. Now Quincy Jones has actually become a mentor in the last 5 or 10 years, and I spent a lot of time with him. There are people who are in their 60s and older have so much amazing knowledge that young people should do anything they can do to try to hang around them and wean that knowledge, because it's not coming back. And
no.
There's always, and I can never learn enough. I mean, whenever I would hang out with the old timers, I would take notes. I would listen to everything they said. I learned about the way it was and the different models and things that happened before I was in the business. And now as the business shifts, I'm actually applying some of that knowledge, and my competitors don't know it because they didn't ask those questions, or they weren't lucky enough to have those audiences.
That's right.
When you listen, Seymour Stein is another one, great, you know, great person, Richard Goddard, you know, these are people who
you're naming
from,
some of my favorite people. And the thing is, you and I are in that league as well, because we were around during the way the industry used to work and have helped pave the way for the way it's moving, you know, the next generation.
For better or for worse, when I got into the music business, it was almost twice as big as it is now. So I feel it's my obligation, and I feel it should be everyone's obligation who's still in the music business, who got into it 10 years ago or 15 years ago, to return it to the next generation in at least as good shape as we inherited it.
Right,
you know,
right.
So, and I don't think we're doing that, and I don't really believe that most people in the business are altruistic, interested in paying it forward to the next generation. I don't think most of them can think still beyond the next year or whatever length their contract is. You know, and one of the great things about this giant new music enema that we've had, this colonic that's cleared out all of the shit of the music business over the last 15 years, is people who weren't in it for the passion for music are no longer in it.
Right.
You're not in it. No one's in the music business now for the money.
That's for sure. If they ever were.
And it's great for me too, because Tommy Boy is getting back into hip hop. And now that hip hop is moving back to passion and away from the money that has driven it for the last 20 years, it's getting to be hugely interesting again for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, that's terrific. A little sideways fun fact that I'm not sure a lot of people that love you know, Tommy, is that you actually studied environmental science at Colby College back in the 70s and went to graduate school in Michigan for environmental geology. And that's a long way from the music business. So I'm curious how your passion for the environment manifests today with the rest of your focus.
Well, I told you earlier that how happy I was to hear Jimmy Iovine use the word ecosystem over and over again. So all that I learned about ecosystem modeling and ecosystem science, which is really what environmental studies was about in those days and hopefully still is understanding the complexities of the ecosystem, and you can't do one thing without affecting everything else. Everything's interconnected. That's so true in the music business too. You can't just cut out ad-supported streaming and not think that's not going to have an effect on piracy. Or,
right.
You know, you can't stop selling singles, which we did as an industry, and not think that they're going to find a way to get singles for free because you stopped selling them for $2.98 or $3.98 or whatever they were, and they found a way to get them with MP3s. I mean, people will get what they want if you don't find a way to give it to them. And, you know, singles were important because young kids who couldn't afford albums bought singles and then got into albums, and you know, it was sort of a upstreaming growth factor, and we took it away, and it was gone by 2000. There were no more singles anymore. By 2004, singles started blowing out albums.
Right.
2005, they passed them again, and now album sales have been decimated because, you know, basically, what we're suffering from in the music business is our own fault. You know, it's just like global warming. You know,
right.
When you mess with the ecosystem, you get Mother Nature takes its toll, and we're basically suffering now from the karmic consequences of the decisions and the choices that we made in the 90s.
I couldn't agree more. So well said.
So there's my environmental connection.
I know you did a brilliant job of tying what to most people look like a lot of disparate industries into one conversation very eloquently, I might add. So, Tommy, it's just been such a pleasure to have you again and have this chance to interact with you. It's an honor, and I appreciate you making the time. So,
you're welcome,
once again,
and I'm looking forward to getting back into Tommy Boy as soon as the seminar is over, because we're on fire now at Tommy Boy.
I love that for you, and it's back to your roots, but now with a lot of, you know, a lot more opportunity and possibility than you had when you first started it. So,
yeah, we really go straight
to Killa.
So much good stuff coming right now in the hip hop world. We think we can have a real big impact again.
Well, I'm thrilled for you on both fronts, NMS and the label. And for listeners, again, check out nomusicseminar.com. It's coming up here in about 2 weeks, June 20, 21st, 23rd. And, Tommy, I look forward to our reconnecting next time I'm in New York.
Yes, please come to New York. I miss you.
Yeah, I've not been there in a bit, so I'm due out for a trip, but I'll be sure to reach out when I come. And I want to thank our show producer, who always does a wonderful job, Jessica Mastor, and all of our listeners who join us each week. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.